Industry Pods and Evergreen Podcast Network are pleased to present the following podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another LA Blockchain Summit event. This one is called Ethereum 2.0, What to Expect When You're Expecting. My name is BJ Pyrus. I'm one of Cointelegraph's reporters, and I'll be your moderator for the show. As many of you are probably aware, Ethereum is expected to see its blockchain upgraded, which will move the blockchain to proof of stake consensus. This significant upgrade has been in the works for quite some time and has seen several delays. It's definitely a big development worth talking about. Today, joining us to talk about it, we have Aditya S. Kungar, a blockchain researcher at the Ethereum Foundation, Maneeb Ali, co-founder and CEO of decentralized application company Blockstack, and Tim Bako, senior product manager at blockchain software company Consensus. Welcome, guys. Thanks so much for coming on. So, can you each give just a real brief, as brief as possible, 15 to 20 second intro on yourself? Maneeb, do you want to start?
Yeah. Hey, everyone. Maneeb here, co-founder of Blockstack. We bring apps and smart contracts to Bitcoin. So I guess I'm actually the Ethereum outsider here on this panel.
Hey, everybody. My name is Tim. I've been working on Consensus Protocol Group for the past 2 years. There we develop Ethereum clients, both for Ethereum 1 and Ethereum 2.
Excellent. And Aditya, you want to go?
Hey there. I'm a researcher on the EF Ethereum Foundation's ETH2 research team. I work on Consensus and Proof of Stake. And I've been working on Casper and this ETH2 network upgrade since 2 years.
Excellent. And so Aditya, do you want to just start us off? I know there's a lot that goes into Ethereum for people who have been following and maybe some people who have not. Like I mentioned, there's just so many different developments coming and there's delays. Can you just briefly summarize the situation and kind of what's going on for people who aren't up to speed?
Yes. So ETH2 is a massive upgrade for the Ethereum blockchain. It brings two major kind of parts. One of them is proof of stake, which is a philosophical differences in how a blockchain is validated. And the second part is massive scalability through sharding, which is splitting the network into multiple parts.
Excellent. Nice and concise. So Tim, question for you. Will Ethereum 2.0 replace the current version of the blockchain? And will there be a new asset while ETH remains in existence? Or will ETH 2.0 just have the same asset as we currently have?
So that's the tricky one. So the way Ethereum 2.0 is designed is to launch as a separate chain from Ethereum 2.0 on day one. And so you'll have the Ethereum chain, Ethereum 1.0 as it exists today, that keeps on going on. And like Aditya says, Ethereum 2.0 aims to change a lot of things about Ethereum. So it's being rolled out in phases. So there's phase zero, phase one, phase two. And the first one of these phases, which we expect sometime late this year, early next year, is just the proof of stake consensus. So because this was kind of the most complex part of the system, they wanted to roll that one out first and basically have the system just have all the validators run the proof of stake consensus and do nothing else. And so while that happens, we obviously want to keep running applications on Ethereum. And so the Ethereum 1.0 chain will keep going in parallel. In terms of the assets, if you want to become a validator on Ethereum 2.0 and earn a reward for doing so, you need to basically burn your Ether on the Ethereum 1 chain, and then you'll be credited the equivalent amount of Ether on the Ethereum 2 chain. And it's worth noting, I guess, there that this is a one-way mechanism. So what you're saying when you do that burn is you want to be a validator on the Ethereum 2.0 chain all the way until it's fully deployed. So all the way until it can run applications, which is expected to take a couple of years afterwards. So in the meantime, you do have this situation where you have Ether on the Ethereum 1 chain, and you also have this Ether that's been deposited on the Ethereum 2 chain, which originally was the same Ether, but once you deposit it to validate on the Ethereum 2.0 chain, you can't bring it back into the original system. That'll happen, as I said, a couple of years afterwards.
Gotcha, that makes sense. And then Aditya, just more on the logistics side, what are the transactions per second now as Ethereum currently stands, and what will they be for Ethereum 2.0?
Right. So currently, Ethereum 1 processes about 20 transactions per second. With Ethereum 2, we are expected to have 64 shards, and each shard has the throughput of Ethereum 1, which is a 64 times improvement in throughput. So it goes from about 20 transactions per second and gets us about 1,300 transactions per second.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a significant upgrade. So if we want to just dive into the meat of this thing here, based on, I mean, each of you have pretty vast experience. Manib, if you want to start this off, what's so important about Ethereum 2.0 in your opinion?
Yeah, so I think maybe a little bit of background might be relevant here. So my expertise is mostly in distributed systems. So I've done a PhD at Princeton University focusing on distributed systems, scalability, mostly like scaling cloud computing and those kind of systems. So I think what's really important with ETH2 is effectively the scalability limitations on ETH1, which people have known about, right? It's nothing new. Even if you go back to like 2016 or 2015, people were aware of the scalability limitations on ETH1. Like effectively, people remember like CryptoKitties, right? That was a classic example that, you know, CryptoKitties is unable to scale, but you could just do pen and paper calculations on, hey, would an application like CryptoKitties be able to scale, and know that, no, it's not gonna scale. So that's where the origins of the ETH2 system starts, that the idea is that ETH2 is going to replace ETH1 and it's going to be much more scalable. And that's where the two things come in, right? Like the idea of proof of stake, and sharding, which I think sharding is actually more important and probably should be discussed a little bit more, because the key scalability improvements are coming more from sharding and not so much from proof of stake. Proof of stake helps as well, but it's not the key thing over there. And I think one of the things that has happened is for whatever reason, you know, ETH2 has taken a little bit longer. It has given the opportunity for a bunch of like these different protocols, like, you know, there would be at least like five other sophisticated teams out there that are kind of like saying, while ETH2 is not shipping, here's a new protocol that has proof of stake or that has like some version of sharding or some other scalability property where you can go. But I think the interesting thing here is that ETH1, at least in my view, might not have worked for decentralized applications, but it did work really well for financial products like DeFi that do not require the kind of scalability that a Twitter-like application might require. So that I think the big question is that how do you enable kind of like really scalable decentralized apps? And ETH2 is kind of like the answer there from the Ethereum community.
And that's interesting that you say just that ETH1 regarding scalability, because I know there's some scalability problems with DeFi right now with high Ethereum fees and stuff like that. So that'll be interesting to see how that kind of changes. And that's kind of my next question. But Tim, do you want to weigh in on what, in your opinion, is so important about ETH 2.0?
Yeah, so I think I'll give a big plus one to everything Manib said. You know, I think he gave a good overview there. And based on just your recent comment on, or your last comment about DeFi and the recent fee problems, I think the biggest challenge with any blockchain is as the demand for the block space like increases, you know, that block space becomes more and more valuable, and the way you charge for that in most cases is fees, right? And the only way to reduce the cost is to increase the supply of block space on available on the chain. And there's different ways to do that. So Ethereum 2.0 is taking the approach of sharding computation, which means you basically split your, instead of having one chain, you have 64 that are all run in parallel, and you've, you know, created like this fixed increase. But even that is probably not enough, because if we end up in a spot, you know, in a couple of years where Ethereum is more than 64 times as popular, we'll be back here. And I think this is where a lot of the Ethereum 2.0 roadmap is starting to change to accommodate layer two solutions. So layer two solutions basically run these side chains or these different types of, you know, of anchors into the blockchains that have different set of trust properties, which people can use for different types of applications. So for example, if you want to run an application like Twitter on, you know, and commit some parts of it to your chain, you maybe don't need the same types of guarantees as if you're sending, you know, millions of dollars on chains. And so you can create some layer two solutions that are more scalable and that work a bit better for that use case. And that's something we're starting to see more and more on Ethereum. So on the Ethereum 1 chain, Rollups are now the flavor of scaling that a lot of projects seem to be looking at. And they provide a way for projects to just move a lot of their computation off of the base layer of the blockchains. So they don't have to pay the high fee there on every transaction, but only when users wish to like join the application or leave it. And I think we'll see more and more of that. And the design of Ethereum 2.0, before we have the sharded blockchain, which runs 64 Ethereum chains in parallel, we'll have what's called like data chains. So instead of doing computations, this chains just store data. And that's a way where layer two solutions can maybe store some of the data that they need a bit cheaper on chain, and also help with the fees there. So I think, I guess to just summarize that, like, it's important that we don't just rely on sharding the chain as the only way forward, because that's kind of a fixed, you know, increase in throughput by however many shards we have. And if the community and the interest to use Ethereum grows quicker than that, then we haven't made like a net progress. Whereas layer two solutions tend to provide much, much more scaling, because for just one transaction per user, more or less, you can get, you know, an almost infinite number of transactions on their sidechain.
Awesome. Aditya, what do you got?
Yeah, basically everything that the two speakers before me said. But also, the problem with ETH1 right now is scalability, of course, and this manifests itself in high gas fees, which means that the more mundane applications on the blockchain are rarely used because it has a high cost to use. So I think that with this holy grail of scalability, we would see like lower gas fees, more mundane applications being deployed, and this would lead to kind of Ethereum applications proliferating more of our daily lives.
Excellent. And so each of you kind of touched on this as well. I'm going to dive into decentralized finance next. For listeners who aren't familiar, decentralized finance essentially is has ballooned in crypto this year, and it essentially is lending and borrowing on the blockchain and directly interacting with other people and all of the above. So how do you guys each think Ethereum 2.0 will affect DeFi? Tim, do you want to start that off?
Sure. So I think the main concern that DeFi folks had about Ethereum 2.0 was the fact that it would split, that if you split things into shards, a lot of DeFi applications don't necessarily work as well, because what's enabled a lot of DeFi is the fact that you can use DAI, deposit it in another protocol, insure that deposit with yet another protocol. And in order to do that quite quickly or efficiently, you need these smart contracts to be able to talk to each other. So there's a couple of things that have changed in the 2.0 spec to allow that better. So the communications between shards has been made quicker. But at the same time, there's always going to be kind of that delay if things are on different shards to communicate between each other. And it'll never be as good as having a single shard where you can do a lot of things within a single transaction. And I think this is why, like I mentioned, we're seeing a lot more emphasis being put on having these layer two solutions that could run some DeFi apps, and also just reducing the number of shards. So Aditya mentioned at the beginning, there's 64 of them, and the original spec of Ethereum 2.0 had 1,024. So that's another way in which, I think the spec has moved towards trying to accommodate those projects and have Ethereum be the platform that makes the most sense for them.
Yeah, that makes sense for sure. Muneeb, what do you think?
Yeah, I can expand on that a little bit, right? So the concept of sharding, it comes from, databases, and there are different types of workloads for which sharding works really well. More specifically, like if you can actually contain most of your logic inside a single shard, right? That's where you get the most benefits out of it, right? So let's say you're just replicating the same type of computations, hundreds or thousands of times over, but the shards are self-contained, right? They don't need to talk to each other that much. Like that's a really good use case to use sharding, right? I think the critics of the sharding, which I actually consider myself one of them, would say that if you look at the workloads on the ETH1 chain or any blockchain, the workloads, the distribution is that it's smart contracts are almost like at randomly talking to each other. So it's very hard to predict what the workload is going to be. So you cannot really fit a certain type of workload inside a shard. And I think that's the thing that Tim was bringing up, that if the smart contracts need to talk to smart contracts, which are in other shards, what happens then? Like the extreme case of that would be like, imagine that there is a shard. I'll give the example of Uniswap, right? Like everyone wants to talk to Uniswap. And if to talk to Uniswap, everyone is communicating to a single shard, then that shard becomes the biggest bottleneck for scalability. And you're kind of like going back to having a single single chain, right? So those are type of things that I think still need to be ironed out more. And I'm personally a bigger fan of layer two type solutions, or even side chains or chains that, you know, connect to another base chain and basically represent like thousands of transactions in a single transaction or a single hash on a base chain, because I think the workloads are such that people want to settle on a single chain and be on the global kind of like same state there.
Yeah, and that kind of just everything you guys have said so far just brings me to the point that like we're really early in this. We're early in crypto, but we're also really early in DeFi. And it's just interesting hearing you guys test out these kind of theories and like experiment with what might work. And it's just an interesting part of being so early to this party. Aditya, what do you think? How will Ethereum 2.0 affect DeFi?
Yep. So as Tim said, the fundamental assumption in DeFi apps right now is that every contract can talk to every other contract. And that assumption is not going to hold for ETH2. Basically, when you partition the contracts into separate shards, they'll not be able to talk to each other that easily. And this can lead to kind of a fundamental revamp of how DeFi applications work. Maybe we'll see some like self-contained DeFi applications that don't really need to talk to other smart contracts much. So yeah, as you said, it's really early in the space, and you know, it hasn't evolved to a point where it's mature yet. So there's a lot of scope for like developing a different class of applications.
Excellent. And I'll start this next question off with you. I know a lot of traders are probably interested in this question, but speculatively, some people will play the speculation, the buy the rumor, sell the news type thing on whenever Ethereum 2.0 launches. How will Ethereum 2.0 affect the value of ETH coins? And I mean, last year, a couple of years ago, I remember seeing an argument that there wasn't essentially like ETH could function with its coin at $0. Like, is there a need for it to be like worth anything in price? I don't know. That's a question I've had, and I figure a lot of people have had that same question. So what are your thoughts on it?
Right. So the first part of that question, I cannot answer because I definitely don't understand crypto markets, or maybe even any markets in general, not so good at that stuff. But your second question, which is, can the network operate at ETH price being zero? The answer is no. And the fundamental reason there is proof of stake operates on the premise that if validators do something bad, if they're trying to attack the system or misbehaving in some way, then they'll be penalized. And these penalties apply to their stake, which is in the coin ETH. So ETH price has to be like greater than zero for the penalties to have any kind of effect in terms of incentive.
Interesting. Tim, do you have anything to weigh in on that?
I'll agree with what Aditya said. I think it's extremely hard to speculate on the value of ETH, and it's a pretty volatile market, so I won't make any predictions there. And you can't have, you know, a price of zero. And I think with proof of stake, the security of the network is somewhat tied to the price, kind of like where in the proof of work network, it's tied to the hash rate, right? And there are mechanisms that can adapt the network if the hash rate lowers or raises. And proof of stake has similar mechanisms for price, but you know, those definitely break down once you hit zero.
Interesting. Manib, did you have anything different to add? Or more the same?
No, I think I absolutely agree. The price can be zero because it's a fee for computation as well, not just proof of stake part, because you're paying for smart contracts computation, and computation can't be free, right? Like this is actually a very scarce type of computation. It's not even like a AWS server that, you know, you pay $10 for and can run for a month. Like the blockchain computations are by definition very, very scarce. On proof of stake, I would just like share like my perspective that, and not proof of stake just for Ethereum, but proof of stake, the concept in general, and there are many blockchains now that use it. It scares me because when people talk about like a malicious actor can get slashed, even a honest node can get slashed depending on various types of network conditions or errors. I think Polkadot recently went through it was a week or two ago where there was one of their validators, when people know this is not a malicious node, it just went offline for whatever reason and got slashed. And I think people don't expect that, right? Like it's a little bit like there's a mismatch between users' expectations that they're like, I'm just putting money in and I have this return, and they don't understand the risks over there where what if you get slashed not because you were being malicious, but you get slashed because of some network error. You were disconnected from the network for a while, you came back online, or whatever server you're deployed, you know, like bugs happen in data centers all the time. So those are the kind of things that scare me a little bit more about proof of stake. If people understand the risks, then I would still feel better. I would be like, okay, people understand that these are the type of risks that they're entering into. But my fear is that people don't fully understand those risks, right? And they think of proof of stake as this guaranteed, almost like a yield that they're gonna get if they just participate.
And yeah, I would definitely plus one all of that. I think it's worth highlighting that, you know, these things are risky. I kind of like the fact that on Ethereum 2, you kind of can't get your money back unless you're willing to commit for a couple of years as a sort of filter for that. And I know the EF's been working on a UI for the deposit contracts that makes it clear with, you know, seven types of warning throughout that you are locking your funds and you need to validate. And one thing, maybe Aditya can speak to this better than me, but I know the E2 spec tries to take into account the fact that most people validating are not, you know, professional DevOps people with 99.99% uptime. And that on net, if you're up, I believe last time I checked the spec, it was something like 2/3 of the time, your reward should be net positive. So you might get slashed some small amounts, you know, if you're online at a bad moment, but that the aim is that for someone who's online more than 2/3, I believe, of the time, they would still have a net reward at the end.
Aditya, did you, I know you...
Yep. So two things. One, building on Tim's arguments where, definitely the ETH2 spec kind of won't slash you just because you were offline for a bit. Unless there is an extended period of time that you're disconnected from the network, or you explicitly do something bad, or there's a bug in your software, there is no expectation of being slashed. The other part is ETH2 staking is, at this stage, I would caution our listeners about just participating in it as a retail like staker. It definitely takes some amount of technical expertise to understand the client software and how to run it, and the best practices for doing so. So I would definitely caution everyone before they enter into this.
Excellent. So we have just about 5 minutes left, and I have two questions that I really want to ask. So one, Aditya, this is kind of just for you here as someone who works on Ethereum. Why has Ethereum 2.0 taken so long to launch and had so many delays?
Yep, great question. So up till about 12 to 18 months ago, the progress was such that at each milestone, we had some substantial like incremental research updates. And at each step of the way, it made sense to wait for the research to be finished and incorporate those changes into the new system that would be launched. But like about 12 to 18 months ago, we stopped having those kind of milestones where breakthrough research is happening. And from that point on, it became just like it became a race to implementing the software and then launching the mainnet. So right now we are in a phase where everything is in the hands of the client implementers. The mainnet, the time to mainnet is a factor of how fast the client implementations can be polished.
Excellent. And then 4 minutes left, and this is a really tough question because it's highly debated, but let's see what you guys can do with it. Is proof of stake more centralized than proof of work?
So really briefly, I'd like to say that it is a philosophical difference between proof of work and proof of stake in how they operate. But I think proof of stake is a little bit more decentralized just for the reason that the operational expense is a little bit lower. And basically, you don't need like physical space. You don't need to maintain a server or anything of that sort. So it seems to me that, you know, at some point in the future, retail investors or stakers might be able to participate and provide like security to the network in returns for staking rewards. So it seems to me that proof of stake is more decentralized. But of course, there is a philosophical difference between how proof of work and proof of stake work.
Awesome. Manib, what do you think?
I think it basically depends on your definition, right? Like this is one of those topics where the argument is not about which one is more decentralized. The argument is more about how do you define decentralized? And depending on your decentralization definition, one might be better than the other. I think I'm personally more in the proof of work camp, not because of the decentralization arguments, because pools happen and then certain companies might be more efficient at producing proof of work hardware and so on. I'm more in the camp from a security perspective, that you're destroying electricity and you're burning, like all that burning process like is there for a good reason. Like there are bootstrapping problems and other security issues. And obviously I'm biased because we have been working on almost like a variation of proof of stake that derives its benefits from proof of work, right? So we anchor into the Bitcoin chain, we benefit from the security of proof of work there, but it's a stake-like system where people can earn rewards. So I think you're not wrong to say that it would be a very highly debated thing, because if people have different definitions, right, they would come up with different answers.
I really like how you phrase that too, just because I have seen firsthand how just people use different arguments, and they are different, like they're different theses for their definition of decentralized, centralized. So that's an awesome comment there. Tim, we got about one more minute. Do you have anything to add?
Sure. So I'll make it kind of a point, both in favor of proof of stake and proof of work. So I think that one of the nicest things about proof of stake is because it's purely digital, right? There's no economies of scale. So if I run like one GPU miner in my apartment, I'm much less efficient than somebody running like a data center because of the economies of scale. Whereas if I run 32 Ether on proof of stake and, you know, Aditya runs 3200 because he's a whale, just kidding. He doesn't start off like with a better than me, right? Like obviously he'll make more money than me, but he can't like stake better than I can. On the other hand, the one thing that proof of work has that proof of stake doesn't is you can verify it offline. Like you can't fake the proof of work, and that's maybe the topic of another session. But the fact that, you know, you can just verify this computation and know just by looking at it that it's the right one is like a really strong property that I think is sometimes underrated.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for coming on. This was awesome. And audience, be sure to tune in for the rest of the panels that we have going. And thanks, everyone.
This has been a production of Industry Pods in association with Evergreen Podcasts Network. Hear this and other Industry Pods at evergreenpodcasts.com, your favorite podcast app, or listen at industrypods.com for your number one virtual conference podcast experience.